We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, our producer, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be talking a little bit about doing history, as it is sometimes done by people who are not professional historians or don't think of themselves that way. I think that one of the points that we want to make is that doing history is not simply for historians, and that more and more in places around the world, there are communities where people are working to document their experiences and their history and putting together independent community archives to do that. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Andrew Flynn. He is a senior lecturer, and he's also director of the Archives and Records Management Program in the Department of Information Studies at University College London. And he is here visiting the campus to give a talk on this very subject, talking about independent and community archives. This is part of the MillerCom series, a lot of sponsors here on the campus. His talk will be this afternoon at 4. This is taking place in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. And these programs are always open to the public. Anyone interested should feel welcome to stop by. And also, as we talk here on the program, questions, comments are welcome, too. Just a little bit more about our guest. He's interested in a number of things, including community archives and memory, archives and public history, grassroots political activity and heritage. He's also an active research historian. He's interested particularly in 20th century British and South African social and political history. We're glad to have him here in the studio with us. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along a question by email, well, you can do that too. Will-talk is the address, and that's just like it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
I know I have looked at some of what you have read, what you have written on the subject, and maybe it's good to start with a basic question, and that is to talk about what it is that we are talking about. And I gather that actually that's the matter of some conversation when you say, well, what do you mean by a community archive? What is that? I guess depending upon who you ask, you might get some different answers.
You might get a lot of different answers. And indeed, we call community archives, we lump in under the term community archives lots of things that people themselves would never refer to as community archives. So they refer to what they're doing in a whole number of ways. But I think what I'm trying to get across is this idea of people taking the initiative for collecting materials about the history of their community, where they live, their ethnicity or their race, or many different kinds of ways in which they're identifying themselves and a group of people that they share history and heritage with. Sometimes, in a sense, because they think other people haven't done that, or that they haven't done justice to that history, or they've left people out of history, and this is a way of putting themselves back into that history or discussing that history amongst themselves.
And are we particularly talking about groups that we either think of themselves as having been marginalized or truly have been marginalized, and it's for them, it's an effort to assert their identity, preserve their history, and in a sense try to move themselves physically back into the mainstream?
I think there is a lot of that, and there is certainly a kind of a sense in which wishing to engage. Sometimes people have used the words to me about rebalancing history, that they feel that the history that is told isn't fair or leaves out aspects, and that these are efforts in certain services to re-engage with that, to intervene in those historical narratives and say, look, this is our history, this is what we did, this is how we experienced those events. But I think there's also a different aspect to it, which I don't want to sort of overlook, that it's not always about that kind of sort of more politicized identity-based history. Sometimes it's a local community that feels perhaps geographically removed from where the main museums or archives are, and that their history isn't particularly represented in those institutions, or they may be several hundred miles or numbers of miles away. And so that they think, well, we're going to create our own institution, we're going to write our own histories, we're going to perform our own plays about our history, and we're going to collect some material about that.
Yeah. This is something that you are, from being from the UK here, particularly interested in the UK, and have done some work looking at it, and have found apparently that there, within recent decades, you're starting to see more and more of this kind of activity.
Yes, I think that's another important point that I've wanted to emphasize, is that this is in some ways not something new. Mm-hmm. That in terms of local history and local history groups, that, you know, this maybe goes back several hundred years in some cases, and certainly in the post-war period from the 1950s, 60s onwards, there was a whole flourishing sort of genre of community history, oral history, identity histories, black history, women's history, and these are all kind of sort of, you know, quite significant genres of histories themselves. But what happened, I think, probably in the late 1990s, the early years of this millennium, was emboldened by technology or enabled by technology. There was a kind of sort of revival in this kind of activity, and an expansion of this activity, a greater recognition that it was going on, and people were using the internet, not only the internet, but they were doing things in other places, but they were using the internet to post up documents, to share histories, to share photographs. And what was became particularly interesting, I think, is the that participatory nature of what was allowed. So you could put up an image and then allow other people to comment on it, to identify people within it. If you put up a picture of a school class or something, people would identify the different people in there, or they'd identify who lived at particular houses on a street view. So it became a kind of sort of sharing and participatory activity amongst a given community.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good illustration of the fact that within communities, there is an awful lot of knowledge and information there, yeah. Knowledge and information that's certainly in danger of being lost as the community ages, and that what we're seeing here, perhaps, is more and more people saying, if we don't make some effort to try to preserve that knowledge, it will be lost, and if we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it.
Yes, absolutely, and I think that takes on a particular urgency in some cases when that community feels that it is threatened or endangered. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of projects emerge around issues around community redevelopment, around gentrification, around those kinds of pressures on the community, where a community has felt that it's had a strong physical identity. It had a sense of place, and that sense of place and that sense of community that was located within that sense of place is being kind of sort of split apart, being drawn apart by people moving in or redeveloping an area, bulldozing areas and that kind of thing. And another area where this sometimes happens is deindustrialization. So where occupations have disappeared, where communities, you know, have a strong focus on a particular occupation, be it a factory or a mill or a mine, when that occupation is removed, you know, other things happen to that community, and at that point there's often a sense in which, you know, there's a focus on trying to recover, to ensure that the community memory that surrounded that around that occupation and that life and that experience isn't entirely lost.
Mm. And this is something that as I said, you've been particularly interested in looking at this in the UK, mm-hmm. And that it is something that in recent decades you have seen a lot more activity in this area, as far as you know, as you've been able to see and have talked to other people. This is not just something that's going on in the UK. It's going on all over.
Absolutely not. No, it's very much, you know, I don't wish to kind of sort of make claims for things that I'm not entirely sure. But as far as I can tell, you know, it is happening everywhere, and in fact, you would expect it to happen everywhere. Once you think about why people are doing it, there's no reason why it should happen in one particular location and one particular country. It will be different, and there will be different manifestations of it. In some places, it may be more orally born, and there'll be less sort of physicality to the creation of the history or the archive. But this need to connect people and a community to a heritage and a history, I think, is universal. So I've seen, you know, in the few weeks that I've been in this country, you know, I've spoken to people and seen examples and read examples of projects that seem to me to be very similar to those ones that I've observed in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. Maybe is there a particular project that you have observed that you think is particularly interesting, or maybe just a good illustration of what we're talking about?
In this country?
I meant in where you're from, okay. in the UK.
Yes, I mean, there are a number of ones, and perhaps if I give a couple of examples, that'll mm-hmm. give some idea of the kind of the scale of these things. So one that I keep coming back to because it's very personally interesting to me is I lived for a long time in an area in Manchester in the north of England, which is called Hume, which is was a particular area of public housing, quite high social deprivation, crime. It was a particular area, but it also had for a period from around the late 1970s to the 1990s, a very particular counterculture. It was quite influential in terms of music and politics and local culture and artistic endeavour. And I lived in that area until about 2000. But from 1995 onwards, this area was redeveloped and effectively bulldozed. And you go back to that area and you can't really see any sign of that. Two years ago, I stumbled across a site on the internet which was just full of photographs, memories, recollections of that area, living in that area. And I often come back to talking about this site because of the reaction that it provoked in me. This was an area where I lived for a long time, had a great amount of affection for it. There was a lot that was good and there was a lot that was bad in that area, but it was an important area, an important time, but disappeared to all intents and purposes. And this project, very small scale, I don't know really who's behind it, I don't think there's any public money behind it, it's just a website, but it's attracting quite a lot of interest from people who lived in that area. So you got that at one scale. It's quite personal, but also about a community memory. You've got much bigger, more significant projects, perhaps much more politically engaged projects, like, for instance, a project that's been going in the East End of London, which is a large part of London, very ethnically diverse, very culturally diverse, kind of has a history of waves of migration. The Jewish people came there in large numbers in the end of the 19th century, and now it's quite an area defined by kind of sort of Somalians and Bangladesh. So it's kind of, you know, very and then a traditional white working class population. So it's an area of a very kind of sort of interest, but it's also an area that has a what we would call a hidden history. There is a way of thinking about the East End, but there is also a sort of a truth or different truths about that place. And there is an organisation that I've got a huge amount of respect for called Eastside Community Heritage, who have been operating in that area since 1990, so over 20 years now, seeking, you know, at first in quite sort of small ways to document those different histories, to record the histories of people, to collect photographs, and just to kind of sort of insert different histories into the way that people thought about the East End, which is all about crime and kind of, you know, just an area where people didn't want to go and stuff. But actually, or there was a kind of another version of it where everybody was loved each other, and there was, you know, everybody left the doors open and there was no crime at all. So it was trying to insert some kind of sort of sense of real lives into that, and they've been doing that for now 20 years, and they've grown into this organisation, which, while still small and independent and community based, you know, is winning large funding projects and achieving, you know, quite significant projects, large projects, you know, encompassing interviewing, you know, several hundred people and this kind of thing. So, I mean, there is a significant range between there, and almost anything in between is possible.
Yeah. Well, that, I suppose, that the one thing that unifies them, on the one hand, you have this thing that seems like it is a very small personal effort on the one hand, and the other thing that has grown into something more significant, activity of a group, possibly some public funds, that the thing that must unite them, and I guess everything in between, is that at some point it had to start with some individuals who took it upon themselves, who said, this is important, this is something I want to do, or maybe a couple of people said, this is something we want to do, and that's the way that it started.
Absolutely. I think in almost all these cases, there are one or two individuals who are core and provide, particularly if they're long-lasting, provide some stability that run through these organisations. And they're the people with lots of people around them who are enthusiastic, who support. But they're the people that really provide the commitment and the drive and perhaps the kind of the motivating thought behind what they're trying to do and what their objectives are. And they're very, very important people in these organisations. But what's interesting, I think, is thinking how other people get involved and participate. So, in particularly in the first example I've given you, it is very small, and I guess there are probably only one or two people who were originally behind it and sustaining it. But then there are lots of other people who are coming to it and contributing materials. They're contributing photographs, or they're contributing memories, or they're sort of amplifying what other people. So the people at the centre kind of sort of enable other people to interact and participate in this activity.
Yeah.
And so it becomes more of the sum of its parts.
Our guest, let me just introduce again a guest in this hour, Andrew Flynn from the Department of Information Studies at University College London. He's an historian and is particularly interested in the ways in which grassroots independent community groups have organized archives or other sorts of effort to document and preserve their local history. It could be history of a particular place, history of a community, history of a kind of group of people, and how that has particularly happened in the UK, but as he has explained, it happened a lot of other places as well. He'll be giving a talk on this subject, talking about independent community archives preserving local histories and sites of resistance this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus. And again, a little later on, I'll give you the information, and certainly anybody can attend. Questions, comments are welcome, too, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm sure this is the kind of thing that it is possible to do as a kind of oral history project, you know, for example. And then when you think about archives, there's got to be some kind of record, but that could be on paper, it could be in a computer, it could be in cyberspace. However, also when you think about archive, you think, well, this could encompass a lot of other material as well, various kinds of printed material, but who knows what mm-hmm. all else kinds of things, actual physical objects. So you start to get from the point where you think maybe this could occupy a file cabinet to the point where you start thinking, well, this could occupy a museum, particularly if you want to have it accessible so people can use and see the material. And I can imagine that if it starts out as an individual effort, you could get to people starting to have a problem because they're trying to store things in the place that they live or perhaps somewhere else.
And it often is that that storing in one's house. You find so many stories of this, and they're so similar. So I mean, I can think of four or five archives that two of them which are in this country and three in England, which have very similar patterns in that there are one or two people who begin by collecting material because they feel that they should, that it's not being collected anywhere else, and the collections just build and build and build, and it drives them out of various rooms of their house, and then it feels the only place in the house. And there's one organisation which I know very well in Manchester, or actually in Salford, called the Working Class Movement Library, and which is a working class history. Political history library. Very famously, the people who'd collected all these materials, to a couple called Ruth and Eddie Frau, wrote at one point about it this being an illness.
collecting
would become an illness, yes. And that there had to be some explanation that there was no room even for a television in their house. And like many of these projects, eventually they had to find bigger property. They had to move the stuff from where it was, into somewhere that was bigger, that was accessible, that allowed people, that it wasn't just about a personal collection, because, you know, personal collecting is one thing. There is an element of personal collecting here, but there's also an element of wishing to share, wishing to use, wishing other people to have access to that material and use it. So, yeah, there's this, particularly in these older ones, it's going to happen less, or we'll have to think about what happens when it's being done largely on the internet, largely digitally. But at the moment, there is certainly this kind of sort of move from something that is something that you hold as something personal into something that becomes collective and shared and becomes accessible in some sort of, we sometimes call it an archive, sometimes it's called a library or a resource centre or a community museum. And all these kinds of constructions are ways of allowing other people to share and then get access to this material.
Yeah. Have there been cases where things like this grew to such significance that it certainly came to the attention of scholars and who said, this is something that needs to be preserved, that the people who started this, it's getting beyond them, so some institution or possibly some public money needs to come in as a way of preserving and perhaps also cataloging and making the material accessible to scholars and anybody who was interested.
Yeah. And here lies, I think, quite a lot of the challenge of exploring that relationship between communities, particularly communities who are inspired by this kind of sort of sense of disadvantage of a marginalized history, that, you know, the control and the custody and the ownership of that material within the community is often, not always, but is often quite important. Mm-hmm. And then we have on the other side this recognition that, from scholars and from professional museum professionals and archivists, whatever, that they might wish to support or to look after. And in the past, there has been, I think, some tension around that, in that there has been a sense that the scholars and the archivists and the museum are trying to take that material. Mm-hmm. They're going to sort of lock it away in their institutions, those institutions that often were perceived as being some of those that didn't tell the story in the right way. And there was kind of sort of antagonism or hostility between, or a misunderstanding. I think what we're trying to do, and I'm trying to do into my writing, is to think about, well, how do we engage in those issues? Because there are issues, important issues, about how this material is looked after. There are important issues about how this material might be accessible to people, but how do we negotiate those relationships with the people who have created it, who have looked after it, so that we're doing them justice, that we're not necessarily taking it out of where they're keeping it, but we're supporting them in looking after it, and that, you know, maybe public money can support looking after this material. So that there's lots of different ways in which that might happen. But what it is exploring those relationships rather than sort of seeking to say, right, well, this is all very interesting now, so we're going to take it and we're going to put it here, and you no longer have that material, because that kind of repeats the problem.
Yeah,
why the collection was created in the first place.
Yeah, it's. I can imagine people thinking, "Oh, you didn't pay attention to us, until we did the work to amass this significant body of knowledge, and now." Now you want to come along and take it.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm sure that, though, that from the archivist point, the professional archivist point of view, they'd say, well, but what you have here is a very significant resource, and it would be nice if it was accessible to people. And, you know, it may be in need of some serious cataloging and organization as well to make it a little bit more user-friendly, something that, I'm sure the professional archivist would say, well, you know, we kind of know how to do that.
Yeah. We know how to do that. We can advise on that. But also, you know, there's recognition that these groups, you know, have done a lot of that work themselves, mm-hmm. and often in some really interesting ways. You know, the cataloging part is not really something that I'm an expert on, but I know in some of the women's history projects, they've developed what, you know, they've termed as kind of sort of radical feminist or feminist schemes of cataloging, and you know, they, again, that would be an issue of both interest but also potential kind of sort of misunderstanding if a librarian came in and said, oh, we know that's all wrong. You know, you need to do it with the Library of Congress standard, or you need to apply this standard to it, and what you've done here doesn't make any sense. Well, and actually it makes a lot of sense within the context of the institution. So it's about, I think, negotiation, and it's about respect, and it's about balance, and trying to find ways in which this material can be recognised for being important and can be recognised that other people might wish to look at it, and how that can be made to happen.
Yeah. We do have, we're at about our midpoint here, and we do have a caller we'd like to bring into the conversation. Maybe I'll just go right ahead and do that in the community of Belgium, not too far away. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to bring into your conversation, maybe you've touched on it. I missed little bits and pieces. As Mr. Inge knows, I'm interested in the wood trade. And one aspect of woodworking that is disappearing very rapidly and is almost completely gone, except in very specialty situations, is pattern makers. Pattern makers were used to make the patterns that made all the molds, that made all the metal parts in all the world. If you have a car, the engine block was made from a pattern. You have all kinds of things, whatever they're cast from. They use a pattern maker to make the mold that you pour the metal in to make the part. Pattern making has a lot of black art to it because there's a lot of shrinkage, there are changes in wood, there's all kinds of very esoteric type things involved with it. But today, most of it is done by CNC. In other words, they have a computer that does it, somebody has a program that works it. But the old traditional pattern making is gone. It's only in very specialty flooring shops do they ever use it. Nobody in production uses it anymore, and it's not done with wood anymore. It's done with plastics. And the thought that that type of work is going to be totally lost to us in a few years when the last of the pattern makers disappear. I know a couple old pattern makers, amazing woodworkers. It's gone. But yet it's probably not something you can put in a library. It's not something you can archive quite the same as you're talking about. How do we handle things like that, sir?
I think it's a really good point, and I do think that this is one of the areas where this kind of work has gone on and will continue to go on. Yes, it's harder to archive than some other ways, but these areas extreme craft and skill, which are in danger of being lost, are precisely the kinds of subjects of oral histories, of working with people in order to somehow document how they did things and to pass those skills, or at least to make those skills available to others at some point in the future, that some people may be able to come back to them. And it may be difficult for them to absolutely recreate the skills and as you say, that kind of sort of that implied knowledge that you had to have of how things could be made to the way that you wanted them. But there is a resource, there are examples, there is a tape of somebody talking about what they did and how they did it. So there is something that sustains that. We know that the world, change happens in the world. And that in some senses this is inevitable, and we can't sort of just hold this back. But we also, I think we do owe it to ourselves and to future to try and save some of that, so that the people can go back to it and at least think about the different ways in which that might be possible to do that kind of work, to recreate those craft activities. And you know, there are a lot of crafts that have been lost, and I think in some cases a lot of effort has been made to try and capture oral histories with those craftsmen before they finally died out.
And it's also interesting, maybe this is strictly the Luddite in me that's coming out, but there are possibilities for things that we do, things that we're trying to move into new technologies. These things can possibly disappear on us too, and we may fall back into a situation where we have to have some of these old crafts, and they'll never be there again because these gentlemen are gone. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I have an email here from someone who was listening to the conversation and was wondering whether people who found community archives try to assess their work in terms of the impact that it has on people that might want to use the archives, and in fact, whether some of these people who have community archives are formalized enough so that they can actually do user studies.
Yes, I think it's one of the areas that I do think we need to spend some more time on as researchers or people interested in this area is trying to assess what the, for want of a better word, what the impact is of these on people that use them, that engage with them. I do think that user studies in this area is something that some of these institutions are at the stage where they are doing, and I think we need to look much more carefully at that. But certainly we can see that in some cases when they're developed, we can think about the numbers of people that are using the material. We can look at hits on websites. We can do interviews with people and talking about their feelings about engaging with this material. I think we're at the beginning of that process of really understanding how these impact on people.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of focus, and our guest is Andrew Flynn. He's a senior lecturer and also is director of the Archives and Records Management Program in the Department of Information Studies at University College London. And he is interested in many things, including community archives and memory, archives and public history, grassroots political activity and heritage. And he is visiting the campus and will give a talk in the MillerCom series talking about independent and community archives this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus. This takes place at the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum, 600 South Gregory in Urbana. And it is open to anyone who would like to attend. So if you'd like to hear what he has to say, all you have to do is stop by this afternoon at 4. And here on the program, questions are welcome. You can call us, 333-9455. That's the local number. We have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Also, you may send email, will-talk is the address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Have professional historians made use of the kinds of community archives that we're talking about?
Yes, absolutely. And in some cases, I mean, this is part of the issue, I think, that it's important to think about, is that, you know, in some cases, professional historians have been involved in this activity, but perhaps not as in their role as a professional historian, that you know, that people have, you know, various different parts of their lives. So in some parts they might be a professional historian, in another part they might be taking those skills and expertise into working into the community archive. But undoubtedly, if you are interested in aspects of African Caribbean experience in London, or if you're interested in working class history, or if you're interested in the history of East London, these institutions, these collections, are incredibly valuable and incredibly useful. I think sometimes they're not well known. And so there's an issue of how visible these collections are. But I think increasingly some of those collections are well known. They're well used by academics. I think there's always a sense in which we would like historians to use more sources than the obvious ones. Mm-hmm. And persuading historians to go beyond the National Archives or the State Archives is sometimes difficult.
Yeah.
But amongst social historians, I think there's a long history of using as many different types of materials, of using oral testimony, of using materials that are located within the community. And one of the advantages of community archives is they are bringing this material together. And so that if you're interested in that material and you can locate the community archive, well, that's the place you want to go.
Yeah. Well, that, and I think that this, I'm sure that this is of great value to historians, particularly as I think more and more historians are, what they're trying to do is that they're trying to look at the everyday lives.
Mm.
And look at the ways in which people that previously would not come up in history books were very important in making history. Well, it's maybe difficult to document everyday lives, but I think in many cases what the kind of efforts we're talking about here, that's exactly what they're aimed at doing, is documenting everyday life.
And this is very much this connection into the kind of sort of concerns of the 1960s and 70s, in which this kind of new history, new social history mm-hmm. really emerged. And this kind of sort of concern with looking not just from the national into the local, but also, as you say, looking into the everyday and valuing the everyday, looking at what might be seen as the personal rather than the public, and taking that as a focus for historical study. Difficult in terms of what were traditional sources, because traditional sources for historical research tended not to deal with the personal, tended not to deal with the everyday. With good reason. They were sources about the extraordinary, or they were sources about the important and the significant, or what was considered important, significant. So different types of history require different types of sources. And oral history was a particularly important way of sort of delving into the everyday and into personal lives, but also letters, diaries. And the materials that make up community archives in a lot of ways are exactly that, sort of delving underneath the surface into the everyday and into the personal life.
Yeah. And it is, I suppose we've touched on this already, but I guess I feel like coming back to making the point that that it is very likely that if someone didn't make the effort to try to collect and preserve the kind of material that we're talking about, it would be lost. I'm sure that an awful lot of material that would be valuable to historians has already been lost.
Yeah. I mean, as a social historian, I can always find use for almost anything, you know, and that's a bad thing. You know, I understand that we need to throw stuff away as well, because we'll just end up with, you know, nowhere to move. But it is the kind of stuff that is all too easy to lose. Traditionally, it hasn't been on the radar of collecting institutions like museums and archives to think, yeah, that's important. Or they didn't have the links in order to be able to collect that material. You know, it's the kind of stuff that gets passed down, you know, through the family until somebody decides, actually, they don't understand what this stuff is, and mm-hmm. there's nobody to explain it, and they're going to throw it away, and it's lost and it's gone. Okay. Unless you're beginning to think about, well, actually, there is some important material here. There are things that are significant that we need to try to start talking to people about what is significant in their records and what they're recording about their lives, and think about ways of capturing that and keeping that.
Yeah. So I wonder if as time has gone along here, people who do history have become more appreciative of things that on the one hand might be dismissed as ephemera, and maybe that, you know, we just don't. From the distant past, we just don't. Whatever we have is what has survived, and that now, though we have a great deal of material that's really vulnerable, that has to be cared for and has to be preserved, or else it won't survive. And maybe we're thinking more and more that kind of material has real value.
I certainly feel so. I mean, I think, you know, what survives from the past is partly purposeful. You know, decisions have been made about it, and that was key. But a lot of what survived survives by accident, and it comes into somewhere where it's a safe space and it's protected. And the reason that it's protected is through chance that it arrived there. More recently, we've moved much more into this area of purposeful collecting and deciding what it is, and making decisions saying that we can't possibly keep everything because there is not enough space for all the paper in the world before we even get into the kind of digital questions. So that we decided to think, well, what's most important? And what tended to happen then is that decisions were made on kind of, well, what's valuable, what has value in terms of the evidence that it gives, and what's ephemeral, and what's ephemeral is going to be thrown away. And there are understandable value judgments that underlie that, but there is also a great danger in dismissing things as ephemeral, particularly from those communities that haven't been well documented and that whose ephemera actually, you know, can be hugely significant because it may be the only or one of the few traces of a certain person or a certain activity or a certain campaign or event that is nowhere else, that isn't documented anywhere else. And so that trace, that leaflet, that badge becomes incredibly significant, not for the information, the quality of the information that it contains necessarily, so much you could read into it, but simply the fact that it exists and that it documents that something happened or a person lived or a person did this.
Yeah, and I suppose that does get us back to the, you talked in the beginning that not all of this kind of archival effort has a political impulse behind it, but certainly some does.
Yes.
And then that gets back to this issue of if you have material, you can't keep everything, you'd have to do some culling. Well, someone is going to make the decision what gets saved and what gets thrown away. And then I'm sure the question a lot of people would ask was, well, who is making this decision? On what basis is the decision being made? What kind of viewpoint comes with that? And how are they deciding, well, this kind of material that documents the experiences of these people and this group is important, but this other material, well, they weren't really all that important, and we really don't need to say that. And if you're associated with that other group, you're going to say, well, wait a minute. How can you say that me and my experience is not important? And so that would drive people, I'm sure, to say, well, if you're not going to – if you don't think this is important, we do, and we're going to make our own effort to preserve it.
Absolutely. And – you know, this is a really difficult area, and it's a really difficult area for people involved in this kind of activity, and it's a really difficult area of involve for anybody who's involved with the teaching and the education of archivists. Is how do we get around this issue of selection and choice and appraisal and deciding what's valuable and what's not? It's hugely difficult, and you know that. In some cases, I'm sure there have been very crude exclusions that people have made decisions on the basis of what they think is important and have, you know, indulged their prejudices and said, well, but that group isn't important. And, you know, I can certainly see that will have happened in the past. I think more likely now is that we still have a kind of sort of sense of what's important, and we focus on the institutional, on the government, on the official. And maybe we don't have the connections with different communities so well, so it's harder for us to collect in those communities. And so there are a whole range of attempts to try and make this scientific, to try and develop a scientific way of collecting material and making sure everybody's collected and appraising it fairly. I'm not sure that any of those scientific models really work, because I think what we have to acknowledge is this is about choice, and we are making choices. And what we have to do is we have to acknowledge and understand our choices and be able to justify our choices. So somebody needs to, you know, if somebody comes on and says, well, why did you make that choice? Why isn't there anything that represents my community? And you need to be able to say, well, I don't know what the answer in that situation is. You're in a tight spot, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, there are going to be circumstances where you're going to be asked questions about why you made a choice to not collect or to destroy something and to keep something else. And you need to be able to say, well, yeah, it was a choice, and here are my reasons for that. And community archives, I definitely play into that whole area of what choices were made in the past and probably what choices continue to be made about what is deemed to be important and deemed to be worthy of representation within an archive or a museum.
Yeah. I suppose the only way that you can really address that, if it is possible, is to find some way to make it so that there's not just one person or a couple of people who are making some choices and doing some collecting. Well, make it possible for a lot of people to do that.
And to get advice, to get other people involved in decision-making processes so that you can set up kind of systems in which you're operating within, where other people can have some input on the decisions you're making. You ultimately take some responsibility for those decisions, but you do so on the advice and input of others.
Five, six, 7 minutes left, perhaps, in this hour of focus. Andrew Flynn is our guest. He is a scholar. He's an historian from the Department of Information Studies at University College London. He's here on the campus to talk about independent and community archives. He'll be doing that this afternoon. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Does this get you thinking about, or does this get one thinking about the question of who is an historian and what is what constitutes doing history?
It does, very much. I mean, I haven't really talked about that side of it today, mm-hmm. but I think that's a very, very significant part of this. And I think sometimes perhaps I've too easily equated the community archive side with the community history side, but I think they're very, very closely linked. If they're not the same thing, they're often done by the same people and they're part of the same product. And it is about often the collection of community materials in the form of a community archive is not just about the collecting, but it's also about the use of that material. And it's about the production of a history. It's about, and that might be done in a whole number of ways. You might put on an exhibition, you might write a book, you might put on a play, you might use it for some form of performance, you might construct a website out of the material that you've got in your archive. So that there is this side in which you're both saying, I'm collecting material because others aren't collecting it, but I'm also writing this history because either it hasn't been written before or those who've written it have written it in ways in which I disagree. Now, you know, people will forever disagree about the different ways in writing history. But the difference, I think, here and the difference in this kind of sort of whole area of community history is to say that history doesn't only need to be written within the academy. It doesn't only need to be written by university academics, but it can be written by the people within that community. Yeah. Now, that's a controversial area of the kind of sort of quality of that history. And there are kind of sort of debates that go back into the kind of sort of the 60s and 70s about, you know, is community history, you know, useful? Is it good history? My take on that is that, you know, good or bad history doesn't fall down on the lines of, well, one's in a university and one's in a community. That good or bad history depends on, you know, how good or bad the historian is at doing his work. And bad history exists in universities as much as it might do in communities.
Mm-hmm. So really what we're talking about, when you're talking about something like a community archive or the effort to gather material together, that really what you are talking about is the raw materials from which history gets made. People who do history, that's what they have to go somewhere to get the material that they then draw on. So that's really what we're talking about, a vast kind of information bank that can be used by anybody who wants to do that.
Yeah, and the second part of that is that the people who bring this material together often are the same people or some of the same people who then use it. So that they're bringing it together in order to use it and to create that history. So that they want other people to use it, but they also often use it themselves for writing of the histories that they deem to be not written.
And the possibility that now just about anything can be digitized and stored and shared that way, I'm sure that has some advantages in terms of access and distribution. I know also some people are sort of worried about actually how robust that kind of material is and whether in fact that there's some chance that one way or another it ends up being lost. What are your thoughts about how the role that the computer has played in all this?
It's very, very significant, I think, and it's significant both as you suggest in your question, both as as an enabling tool that as I think I suggested earlier has kind of stimulated the growth in a lot of this work, because it allows people to quite easily share. There's this participatory approach where people can comment on each other's work, that you can make connections about a place with people who are dispersed all over the world. So that in an older model of community archives, which is physically located, then probably the people that can engage with it are those people who live, for the most part, reasonably close to it. On the web, you can make connections all over the place. And we can wonder about what those connections are like and whether they're the same. But certainly we are, we're building new communities that are distributed in different ways. But there is also the threat of how long-term sustainable this material is. And if we decide that this material is valuable and that it is of significance and that we should be thinking about ensuring that it remains usable and accessible for future, then we have to think about how we manage that. And digital materials are inherently unstable. They're not. Paper can survive for quite a long time if you do very little to it. As long as you don't set fire to it or pour water all over it. You leave a file on your computer for 10 years. And there's quite a good chance that it's going to be a bit of a struggle to open it and read it. So if people invest a lot of emotion and energy and commitment into creating digital archives, we need to think about, well, how can we make sure that those materials are accessible to people in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, going on down the line? And that again may be an area where we can talk about this kind of how the professional museum curators and archivists can work with people with these materials to support that and to think of strategies for ensuring that material is available to the community and to the broader society for a significant period going forward.
Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, but for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Andrew Flynn, he'll be speaking on the subject of independent and community archives, preserving local histories and sites of resistance this afternoon on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series. They're always open to the public, free, no charge for admission. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. He's a senior lecturer and a director of the Archives and Records Management Program in the Department of Information Studies at University College London, and is spending some time now visiting this semester in Boston.
In Boston, that's right.
In Boston. Well, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.